Good to be with you. I will have some introductory thoughts, and then I'll open it up for you to add to the list that I've put together. And our general topic, or the topic that I'd like to spend some time on this morning, is the topic of lying. In Revelation chapter 21, verse 8, it says, "But the fearful and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." In that verse, he gives us a listing of things that we don't want to be guilty of because the consequences of them are hell. But what has probably always struck me with that verse is that he puts liars, which maybe we would not tend to think the most serious mistake one could make, in with whoremongers, sorcerers, and idolaters. And if we were to consider what sins we are most likely to participate in, well, we guess could participate in adultery, we could participate in sorcery, we could participate in any of those. But in that list, the one that's probably most frequently engaged in, even by people such as you and I who are trying to walk the walk and serve the Lord, would be lying. I don't think I've ever met anybody that convinced me they never lied. And if they tried, I would probably think that that was a lie in and of itself. As children, we lie to our parents. We tell them we do things that they want us to do when we haven't, and we don't do things they don't want us to do when we have. And sometimes that continues on. In Proverbs 6, where we have the seven abominable things, many of them have to do with a lying tongue or inability to handle the tongue. I do remember, however, this morning, one public speaker teacher told us to be bright, be brief, and be gone. I'm going to try to do at least two out of those three this morning, and you can pick which two that I do. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 13, we are warned against lying spirits. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, we are also warned against that. But perhaps the most insidious and dangerous lying that any of us ever do is what I really want to focus on this morning in our class period. And that's lying to ourselves. We can lie to God, or we can try to. We can lie to other people, and sometimes they'll call us on that. But I think more frequently than either of those categories, we lie to ourselves. And I find that to probably be the most insidious kind of lying that one can participate in, because who's going to call you on that? If I lie to Ed, he might come back and say, "Now that wasn't right. You lied to me." If I lie to God, he's eventually going to call me on that. If I lie to myself, I'm kind of out there by myself. You don't know that I've done it. God knows, but he's going to let me choose that course if that's what I want to do. So I want to really focus in on lying to ourselves, and lies we tell ourselves in particular. The Greek scholar Diognetus said, "Nothing is as easy as to deceive oneself for what we wish we really believed." In other words, nothing is easier than to lie to yourself because you want to believe that lie so bad. And what we think and how we think makes all the difference in our lives. Now, there are many passages we could turn to, and we could spend the entire class period turning to passages against lying. In 1 Timothy 2 and 2, "Live in all godliness and honesty." Luke 8, 15, "Have an honest and good heart." Acts 6 and 3, one of the qualifications for those early servants was to have an honest report. 2 Corinthians 8, 21, "Honest not only to God, but to men also." 2 Corinthians 13 and 7, "Do that which is honest," and on and on and on. You can get your concordance out and find those verses as well as I do. It's been several decades, maybe even 4 or 5 decades, since a book came out entitled The Day America Told the Truth. And it had to do with the societal lying that is so prevalent in our nation. And one of the surveys they did, and you can quibble with these numbers a little bit, but I think the point is well made. They did a survey of people, and they found that 91% of them lie routinely about matters they consider to be trivial. 36% lie routinely about matters they consider to be important. 86% said they regularly lied to their parents at all ages. 75% regularly lie to their friends, 73% to their siblings, and 69% to their spouses. And as I said, we can quibble about the exact percentages, but I think the point is well taken. We live in a society of liars. We're surrounded by liars, and it's awfully easy and maybe almost natural for some of that to rub off on us. David in the Psalms asked the Lord to search him. Paul in 2 Corinthians 13 and 5 tells us to examine ourselves whether we be in the faith. When we partake of the Lord's Supper, one of the things we're told in 1 Corinthians 11 is to examine ourselves. And no area I think is more important than examining ourselves than in the area of lying, because who else is going to know? Who else therefore can take corrective action? One of the most chilling passages in the Bible for me is Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 23. And in that passage it says, many will say to me in the end, Lord, Lord, have we not done all these wonderful things? And he'll have to say, depart, I never knew you. What he's describing there, I think, are people who maybe sincerely thought they were doing what was right, but they were lying to themselves or had been deceived. William Young, in one of his writings, said, lies are a little fortress. Inside them, you can feel safe and powerful. Though your little fortress of lies, through your little fortress of lies, you try to run your life and manipulate others. But the fortress makes walls, so you build some. They are the justifications for your lies. You know, like you are doing this to protect someone you love, to keep them from feeling pain. Whatever works, just so you feel okay about your lives, end quote. And what he was commenting on was the rationalization we go through to convince ourselves that these little lies or lies are not inappropriate. Sometimes we rationalize or justify them to protect somebody. At least we think we're protecting them. But oftentimes we're doing it to protect ourselves, trying to avoid pain, trying to avoid embarrassment. But how can lying alleviate pain? It can't. It can maybe delay a little bit of the emotional pain, but it cannot alleviate it because we have to answer to God for everything that we do. The Bible is full of liars. The Bible is full of people that have lied. There was Cain, who lied to God. Sarah, who lied to the angel. Jacob lied to his father. Joseph's brothers lied to him. Gehazi lied. Peter lied when he said, I'll never, never deny you. The Psalms is full of David expressing consternation over his lack of truthfulness. And of course, that passage I started the session with, Revelations 21 and 8, all liars shall find their part in the lake of fire. Now that's my introduction. What I've now done is I sat down and wrote down several lies that I think people tell themselves. Maybe I tell myself some of these. Maybe you tell yourself some of these. I'm going to give you some of the ones I came up with, and then I'm going to pause and give you an opportunity to expand this list with lies, and I'm not asking for a public confession. If you want to do that, that's fine. This would be a good group to do it in. But things you've seen other people lie about, or to themselves, or things that maybe you struggle with. And you can get as specific or as vague as you want. You can get as vocal or as quiet as you want. The first one that I wrote down, and these are not necessarily in any order of importance. They're in the order that they came to my mind. is the law. One of the lies I think people often tell themselves is the lie, I can't. I can't. And this lie usually stems or often stems from one of two reasons, I think. Sometimes it stems from a fear that we're going to fail. And we don't want to fail, so rather than fail, we're not going to try. Another reason, or maybe the second reason that came to my mind, is we can use that lie to ourselves because we're lazy. And we just don't want to do it. So we convince ourselves we can't. It's kind of the motto, aim low and avoid disappointment. It's the talent, the man that only had one talent, and he was afraid he'd fail, so he didn't do anything with it, telling himself that he can't. I think the lie that many times we tell ourselves of I can't keeps a lot of people from getting a job that they're fully capable of doing, maybe from getting a mate that would have been a good choice. They just didn't feel that they were able to match up to them. I think it can hinder our service in the Lord because we convince ourselves we can't when maybe we really could, and therefore we rationalize not serving the Lord. One of my favorite men in the brotherhood, he's now dead. He was an elder at Pleasant Hill, Iowa. His name was Bob Flack. Some of you may have met him. I don't know if you ever did. Bob became a deacon and then an elder at Pleasant Hill in Iowa. And he was not the most talented man by any stretch of the imagination. He was not the best singer. He was not the best, he was not the most eloquent speaker. But Bob Flack would do anything. He led songs. He taught class. He gave sermons. He swept the basement. He mowed their churchyard. What I loved about him was he never said, I can't, even if maybe his talents were not on par with some other people. He wanted to do all that he could, and he did a commendable job. I don't mean to say that he didn't. He may have taught better than a lot of more eloquent people. But I really loved that about him. I really respected that about him. Sometimes we tell ourselves we can't because we're just, to be honest, we're just lazy. Let other people do it. I can't. Their I can't is really I don't want to. But we couch it in a lie to rationalize and soothe our conscience. Moses tried the I can't in Exodus chapters 3 and 4. How did that work out for him? I'll mention briefly the parable of the talents. How did the man with one talent, how did that work out for him when he convinced himself that he couldn't enhance it? Barak, you remember the story of Barak when he was with Deborah and he was to go out and lead the army? What did he tell himself? He said, I can't. So he goes back and gets Deborah to go with him. Nothing wrong with taking Deborah with him, but a lack of faith and a lack of willingness to do it. Jonah maybe is an example of thinking, I can't. Peter, maybe thinking he couldn't. One of the lies we dare not tell ourselves is that we can't. If we truly believe Philippians chapter 4, verse 13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. That doesn't mean we all have the same talent. That doesn't mean we're all good singers. That doesn't mean we should all be leading the singing. It doesn't mean we should all be doing everything. But it certainly means that we can in a multiplicity of ways. Lie number two. I'll go through two or three of these and then I'll pause if you have some you want to add to it. Lie number two that came to my mind. Biblical principles and scriptures don't really apply to my situation. This is along the mindset of I know it's true. I know what the Bible says, but my situation is different. Well, all of our situations are a little bit different. None of us have the exact same circumstances, but I believe the Bible was written to cover our circumstances. And if I take the position that, yeah, I know that's wrong for them, but my situation's different, I'm just going to go ahead with what I really want to do. In 1 John chapter 1 verse 6, it says, if we claim to have fellowship with him and yet walk in darkness, we lie and do not have the truth. I've had men tell me that the Lord wants them to leave their families. The Lord doesn't want anybody to leave their families. And I'm sure women have expressed that also. It goes a little bit along with the lie, I can handle it. I know this is a temptation, but I can handle it. Boy, talk about an ego trip. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12 says, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. Often we are most vulnerable when we think we are the strongest, and we therefore don't take the proper precautions to find ourselves deeper in sin than we ever dreamt possible. One of the members of Smart Road, where Donna and I are members, was teaching a class. I wasn't there, but somebody recalled it later, and I thought it was very good. His class was on temptation, and he put on the board this formula: desire plus opportunity equals temptation. And the point he was making, or the point I want to emphasize, is we all have desires, and we all have some desires that aren't appropriate and aren't honoring of God. And when we know what those desires are, don't put ourselves in a place of opportunity to act upon those desires. And what he was saying is, if you know what your evil desire might be, don't put yourself in that circumstance. If you don't have any evil desires, then God bless you, but we know that we all do. How many times we've heard people think or maybe even say, I know church discipline is biblical, but not when it's my family. That's saying it really doesn't apply to my family, my situation, and that is quite different. Number three, and then I will pause if you have ones you want to add to this list. Lie number three that came to my mind is, my happiness, my situation is somebody else's fault. If I just had a better husband, I could really be happy. If I just had a better wife, if I just had better brothers and sisters, if I just had a better, you just keep going with boss, whatever, I could be happy. Well, those people do affect us. But I think that's largely a poor me syndrome. I could be happy if I only had better parents, a better spouse, a better job, a better church, better elders. The problem with that lie is that it keeps pushing off the responsibility and accountability for our situation onto somebody else. And the only person that's going to be able to really change that is you and I. It distracts from our faults so that we can address it and blame it on the faults of others. No one has the power to ruin your life in Christ. Period. Nobody. Only you, and we're all accountable individually, can do that. Stephen Covey, in one of his writings, wrote this very brief sentence: in between stimulus and response is choice. And what he was saying is, in between whatever affects us and whatever consequences occur is our choice to make of it as we would. And we'll talk probably a little bit more about that in our second session with you. We can fill our minds with lies, we can fill them with rationalizations, or we can fill them with the truth of God. Maybe we need to replace finger pointing with, it's my fault. And we don't necessarily always have to say that out loud. We just need to be honest with ourselves. Maybe get down on our knees with the Lord and go to him and ask for help. Even if you look upon the beauty of another person or the handsomeness of another person and you succumb to the sin of fornication, it's not the other person's fault. It's our fault for making that choice. Rather, you and I are to blame for not keeping our hearts and minds pure. In Job 31 and 1, Job says, I made a covenant with my eyes that I should not look upon a maid. He apparently knew that that was a inappropriate desire that sometimes filled his heart. And so he said, I'm just going to take that opportunity away to act upon that desire. The temptation or the tendency to see ourselves as victims is very paramount, in our nation. Back in the 1960s, there was a rather old lady, but she was a folk singer. Her name was Anna Russell. And she made a rather ditty-like folk song popular. It's a little bit humorous if it wasn't so serious. I'm going to read to you some of the lyrics from this little folk song as maybe a way to make a point on this third one that I had. The lyrics went as followed. I went to my psychiatrist to be psychoanalyzed, to find out why I killed the cat and blacked my husband's eyes. He laid me on a downy couch to see what he could find, and this is what he dredged up from my subconscious mind. When I was one, my mommy hid my dolly in the trunk, so it follows naturally that I am always drunk. When I was two, I saw my father kiss the maid one day, and that's why I now suffer from kleptomania. When I was three, I felt ambivalence toward my brothers, and so it follows naturally that I will poison my lovers. But now I'm happy as I've learned the lesson that he taught, that everything that I do that's wrong is somebody else's fault. That is as false can be. And yet it's the guiding path that sometimes, many times people take. And sometimes, dare I say, maybe you and I have to be cautious that we don't take. I'm going to pause now, and I don't know if this is really stimulating toward you giving me lies that you think people tell themselves, but I do want to pause and give you a chance to add to the list or comment on anything that I've said.
One that I've experienced was a man told me, well, I've got plenty of time. And he said that because he was wanting to engage in sin.
Sure.
And I think of the man who built the bigger barns, and the Lord said, this night your life will be required of you. And so, I think that's one that's pretty prominent too.
Yeah, I don't know that I had that on my list, but yeah, the idea that I've got plenty of time, well, everybody here intellectually knows that's false because we just don't know. We just don't know. But never underestimate our desire to rationalize our thinking when we want to do something, we want to justify something. Absolutely. Anybody else?
Not one to add, but I do have a comment on the last lie you brought up, Brother John, is that I call it the it's not my fault lie. And I just personally think that is one of the most corrosive lies that we tell other people, and more importantly, like you say, we tell ourselves. We just try to say, oh, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. And like you say, no one's going to call us to account unless we actually look in the mirror and say, it's my fault.
Sure.
And I just thought that was very important, and I was actually going to bring it up if that wasn't one of the three you had brought up.
Okay, thank you. And maybe I need to comment a little bit more on that. There are things that happen to us in our lives that aren't our fault. Okay, if somebody broadsides me on the way home because they ran a stoplight, I guess that's not my fault. My caution in bringing that up is that we can just take that to the extreme of saying, well, nothing's ever my fault, and none of us are that good. We can all improve and do some things to change some things. Bill?
Kind of closely related to your number one, I can't, is I'm doing the best I can. And most of us, I think, myself included, I don't consider myself that I always do the best I can.
Yeah, I've got this in, yes, thank you. I'm going to jump ahead here and, because I think I had something like that somewhere in here, but maybe I didn't. Well, here it is. The lie of comparisons, I called it. And it goes a little bit along with what Bill just said. I'm doing the best I can. Well, none of us are probably doing the best we can, and that's why we need the grace of God in the end to save us. And if you just, you can just drive yourself totally spiritually insane by saying, I could have done better, I could have done better, I could have done more. That's always going to be the case. But the grace of God does, I think, have to sweep down and pull us up. But we need to do as much as we can. And the other, and since Bill brought that up, I moved ahead to one that I had. It's the lie of comparison. Oh, I'm as good as they are. I teach as good as they are. I teach the kids as often as they do. I visit the sick as often as they do. I do this as often as, and you pick the person. That is so totally irrelevant. What is relevant is how are we doing compared to the ability God has provided us with. There are people that can lead singing, and I will never lead singing as good as they do, for instance. But I can do the best that I can. And you've got song leaders here far better than me. Some of you visit the sick, call the sick better than some of the rest of us. But the issue is not how do I compare to you and how do you compare to me. The issue is how do we compare to the blessings and the abilities and the talents God has given us. He did not chastise the one with five talents for only bringing back five. He didn't say you're not as good as the one that I gave 10 talents who brought back 10. He said you both did according to your ability. What he did chastise was the one who didn't do according to his ability. And we can rationalize, well, I'm as good as they do, or I'm as there as often as they are. Well, maybe you are. I'm just saying that's irrelevant in the way God judges. That's the way man tends to judge. Other comments or questions?
One just hit me is it's sort of the reverse of what you were just talking about. Well, I'm as good as them. There is the reverse of, well, at least I'm not as bad as this person. And I think we all tend to be that way because we hear of so many different stories of people doing horrendous things. And we automatically think, at least I'm not that person. At least I did not do that. And the sad part is that's irrelevant.
It is. We possibly do that negative comparison more than we do the positive comparison. You can always find somebody that's worse than you. But so what? I mean, it's not a good thing because you don't want them to be worse, but we tend to elevate ourselves as we compare to others. That's the point. And elevating or de-escalating ourselves based upon how we compare to others is false math.
Mm-hmm.
False math. Anybody else want to add one? Okay, I'll pause again a little bit later, but let me go ahead. I've got a few more that I jotted down. Sometimes people lie to themselves by saying, I'm not accepted. I just don't fit in. And I've had people leave the church or leave congregations because they didn't feel like they were accepted and they didn't feel like they fit in. Well, I guess that's possible. If a congregation doesn't accept somebody for a non-scriptural reason, that's not a good thing. But I think we need to introspect a little bit. In Proverbs chapter 18, verse 24, it says, a man who has friends must himself be friendly. A man who has friends must, first of all, be friendly. I think that's one of the keys to being accepted, one of the keys to fitting in. A couple of examples. I mentioned Bob Flack from Pleasant Hill. I don't know, I've got Pleasant Hill on my mind, or I did when I wrote these notes down. There was a man who came to the Lord. He was not a particularly deep Bible student, but he was a very people person. His name was Junior. He was a confirmed bachelor. He was probably 60. And they would have basket dinners. Well, what does a confirmed bachelor bring to a basket dinner? Well, I guess you can go to Hy-Vee and do something and take the labels off if you don't want people to know that's what you did. But he had a very unique way. He brought salad to every basket dinner that they had. But his salad was unique. It was a big bowl. And the ingredients of Junior's salad, and he was rather rotund, were Snickers, Milky Ways, Baby Ruth, and Tootsie Rolls. You talk about a popular man. My point is, here's a man that didn't know anybody in the church until he came to the Lord, but he was just a paramount joiner. Paramount. No one would have thought anything about it if Junior had just gone home and not stayed for the basket dinner or not brought anything. They didn't expect him to do that. He was absolutely paramount. Some of you remember, well, all of you now, most of you remember Wendell Sparks. And I could still kind of see where he would sit up here on the first couple of rows. If you ever noticed, and at the dismissal prayer on a Sunday morning service, he would always go out, almost always go out that door. And I used to wonder, why is he going out that door? There's no restrooms out there, and he wasn't getting ready to leave. He was heading for the parking lot because he knew people that would sometimes, that he needed to see the most, were the ones that would head for their cars the first, and if he didn't get right out there, he would not get to interface with them. And I don't mean this because anybody's sitting in the back. Just because you're sitting in the back doesn't mean you're going to head for your cars. I don't mean that. But you know what I'm saying. Sometimes we say, I don't fit in when we don't try to fit in. Or we don't take advantage of opportunities to fit in. Be it the basket dinner, be it the Wednesday night service, be it whatever. So we need to be, I think, kind of careful that we remember that the church is a participatory organization and not a spectator organization. When Donna and I come in here, we come through on 50 Highway. We go through the big, it used to be Baptist Church. I don't know what, it's not called that anymore. And I'm not condemning anybody for going there, although I greatly disagree with them, but it's just such a participatory environment. And we've all seen congregations like that. And one advantage of not being terribly big, and mutual ministry groups tend not to be terribly big, is that participation is more likely and I think more healthy. But let's not tell ourselves I'm not accepted if we're not trying to be accepted. I lost my number because I pulled one out of place. A lie that I think we often can tell ourselves is, I'm here, I'm good, and I'm saved. Well, I'm glad you are here because the Lord wants you to be here. I hope you are good because the Lord wants you to be good, and I hope you are saved. But simply because I am here doesn't mean I am saved. Simply because I partake of the Lord's Supper doesn't mean that I am saved. I need to do those things as a saved Christian because the Lord asked it. But do we have the mindset of a servant? Are we an attender or a participant? How many congregations is church disciplined in such neglected? And people think they're okay simply because they're still on the roll of the church. It's been my experience that by the time we get around to disciplining somebody in the church and maybe, dare I say, having to remove their name from the roll, they have already left God, usually, long before that. And maybe that's the right order because we are to be patient. We are to be long-suffering. But just because the church still has me on their membership list doesn't mean God has me in the book of life. He wants me to be part of a congregation. He wants me to be participating in a congregation. But the most important thing, obviously, is to be in the book of life. Now, I believe church membership is extremely important. I think it's biblical. I think the Lord expects us to put ourselves under biblical leaders that can help us and guide us and that we can participate with. I'm just saying, just because you have that, just because I have that is not a necessity, it's not a absolute indication that I am where I need to be with the Lord. And we can lie to ourselves in that way. I'm going to pause there and see if you have any comments on those last two or some others have come to your mind? Drew, just a minute. He's coming.
I can remember when I was a younger person at, I would sit in the back row at Prince Road, and I thought, I don't have anything in common with these people. I don't fit in. And that was before I was a Christian. And I look back now, and I thought, you know what? I probably didn't have very many things in common with those people. I still don't have a lot of things in common with people. But now I have Christ in common with all my brothers and sisters. And that's the only thing that matters.
That well said. You know, I could take you and I. We have a few things in common, but outside of being in the church, we don't have a lot in common. You like to hunt. I like to eat what somebody else kills. And, you're just different. You're more outdoorsy. I'm more indoorsy. But we got the Lord. Isn't that an amazing thing? You know, and we've all traveled. And you'll sometimes go into a congregation, you don't know anybody. And by the time that you're out, you've met people, and there's a lot of commonality just because of the Lord, because that's all you got. That's the only commonality you have. There may be other commonalities, you just don't know about them yet. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Anybody else want to make a comment or add? Okay. There you're stuck with my last three or four. One lie we often tell ourselves is, I can change them. And this often comes up in matrimony and love issues. Well, I know that once we're married, I can change them. Well, that does sometimes happen. That does sometimes happen. But it's often a lie that doesn't come to fruition. Or I know they've got these bad habits, but I know that I can change them. You know, when you get right down to it, the only person that's going to change them is them. And the only person that's going to change me is me. You can encourage me to change. You can give me a good example. You can influence me. But the change is, that's me or you. And I can't really change people, and you really can't change people. That is between them and God. In 1 Peter chapter 3, the first few verses, it's talking to wives, and it says, you're just not going to be, I'm paraphrasing, you're not going to be able to nag your husband into the Lord. You just need to show him by example, because the change has to be from within. The one I had here, and this goes along with Paul, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. I wrote down, I can do it tomorrow, and I'll get to it. And Paul's comment was, I've got time. Well, we're not going to get everything done today, but we need to do the important things as quickly as we can. Tomorrow I'll study. Tomorrow I'll visit the sick. Tomorrow I'll share the gospel with somebody. Tomorrow I'll tell someone about the truth of the Lord. Tomorrow, 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 tomorrow. I'm going back a long time, so many of you won't remember this man. I wish I'd have known him better. He was an elder here. His name was Vic Gibson. And Vic was, I understand, very, very diligent, and many of the people my wife's age can remember going to Bible studies that Vic and Cleo would host. And I lived with Cleo for a year or two. I mean, she rented me a room. Let's put it in the right context. And Vic had just died. But Vic, I'll get the date slightly wrong, but I think Vic retired like in June and died in July. It was just very brief. He had worked. They had a camper. They were going to do all these wonderful things, good things, in their retirement. And tomorrow just vanished for them. And that can certainly happen to any and all of us. In Psalms 95 and 7, David says, today, if you will hear his voice. He doesn't say tomorrow, if you will hear his voice. He says, today, if you will hear my voice. In Hebrews chapter 3, it says, exhort one another, how? Daily, not tomorrowly, but daily. Because we just don't know. Now, we all understand that intellectually, but we certainly try to convince ourselves contrary to that. Lie number 9, and I've only got one more after this. That's just the way I am. My dad had a bad temper. My mom was a gossip. So I've got a bad temper and I'm a gossip. It's just the way I am. Well, that's a lie. It may be the way you are, but it's not the way you have to be. Because I cannot blame my ancestors on the way I am, because I have that choice. When we start thinking that way, I'm that way because of my ancestors, we're really almost saying, God made me that way. I'm genetically predisposed to lie. Well, maybe it's a bigger temptation for some than it is for others. But that's blaming somebody else. And if we're not careful, we're going to start blaming God for how we are. And God doesn't make bad stuff. We can turn good stuff into bad by the way we use it and the way we conduct our lives. But God doesn't make, I can't blame God and you can't blame God for the way we are because he made us that way. That's the blame game that simply doesn't work. The last one that I wrote down, not the last one, but the last one I wrote down is, no one will get hurt. No one will get hurt. Well, that is such an atrocious lie. When families break up, the hurt ripples in many, many directions. When congregations break up, the hurt ripples in many, many directions. The ripple effect, and some of you are, shall I say, victims somewhat of the ripple effect. You can overcome it, but you're victims of the ripple effect. Whether it's been drugs or bad relationships, not to mention God himself, he grieves. Even if we could convince ourselves that no human is hurt, God grieves when we sin. Genesis chapter 6, verse 6, he grieved over the sinfulness of the world. In Isaiah chapter 63:10, he grieved over the sinfulness of man. Jesus, looking out over Jerusalem in Matthew 23:37, grieved over the state of Jerusalem. I think all sin hurts other people, and it certainly hurts us. But even if it didn't, it hurts God. And our sins always cause pain and grief and tears. If not today, they cause them tomorrow. I think they cause them today, but they may not be manifest or observable until maybe a little bit later when it comes to a more public light. Those are just some that I wrote down. I'm going to again pause. We've got 5 minutes or 4 minutes. If you want to comment on anything I've said, this isn't the most comfortable subject. It's comfortable until we start talking about lies we tell ourselves. That's when it gets personal. But it's very, 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 very important, I think, because it's one of the most insidious things that can overcome us. You're up here.
The one most prevalent today, I think, is that you have your truth and I have my truth. And truth is just, you mentioned, I think, one of them, it doesn't apply, scriptures don't apply to me, and that's kind of related to that. But it's very prevalent today to people to say have two kinds of truth.
Sure. And, you know, there's fancy names for that, postmodernism, and now it's, critical race theory is really a stepchild of that. And I don't mean that in a racial context. It all is built on I decide what's right for me. Well, yeah, you do decide what's right for you, but in the judgment day, what's right, what you decide, doesn't count. It's what God's already decided that counts. The fact that I think it's okay might soothe my conscience, but it's not going to necessarily save my soul if it's not in line with the Lord. Paul?
I just think probably the lie is the most dangerous thing there is, and it's the most harmful thing there is. And if you've ever been involved with a lie that caused somebody extreme harm, it's a lesson for you. You really wish you hadn't had to learn.
Yeah, it's and that was one of the questions I had. And if we have time, well, we can spend just a little bit of time. Why does God hate lying so bad? Why does God hate lying so bad? Pardon? Just a minute. I know. I can hear you.
I know. The devil was the start of the
lies. The devil is the father of lies. Okay. I've always, well, I mean, before I say what I was going to say, why does God put that up there with murder? Why does he put it up there with whoremongering and adultery?
I think it's possible that lying can lead to all those other sins. Like you say, we lie to ourselves, and we say, and that can lead to all these different things.
It can lead to them, and it can be part of the cover up of them.
It just hit me a lie that I think we've all heard, whether we tell ourselves this or not. But one of the biggest lies I think we've heard a little bit last time with Brother Rick's lesson on evolution and the truths of that, the lie of there's nothing out there, there's nothing after death.
Right.
In other words, there's no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell. It's just you're here, then you're gone.
I also equate this, and all that I think is excellent comments, with the passage in 1 Corinthians 14 where it says, God is not the author of confusion. If you have lie, or if you have a relationship with a lying person, it's going to get confusing. And God is not the author of confusion. You really can't have a good relationship with a liar because you don't know where they're coming from. I can have a relationship with Drew because I think he's going to tell me the truth. And if he doesn't, it's a mistake, not a lie. I mean, we all make mistakes. But you just can't have this unity and the bond of peace when there isn't truthfulness and honesty. And that's why it's so important. Barbara?
I think lying has a lot to do with pride, which God also hates a proud person.
I like that. Go. No, you keep the mic. Why do you think that? Well, I agree with you.
Generally, when a person lies, they're trying to save themselves from something that's been said or make themselves look good.
Right. We don't want to let people see the way we are. Somebody asked me, wasn't anybody here? We were just having a conversation, and, well, it was Ed Darlington. I think some of you know him. Ed's been here. We were talking, and he said, what's going to be the first question you have when you get to heaven? I didn't flinch. I knew the answer to that. I'm going to be surprised I got there because I know myself and I know how much better I could be. And that's where I have to rely on the grace of God and continue to try to strive for it. And then I said, the second surprise I'll be is how in the world did they get there? And I don't mean to be flippant with that, but we all know ourselves so well that we sometimes just feel so inadequate because we are inadequate except for the grace of God. And that's what makes it all doable. But that can't be an excuse for us to lie and rationalize ourselves into thinking that we don't need to be doing some things that we know we should be doing. We got another one? Go ahead.
One of the things that I think is that when we lie, we're the farthest away from God that we can be because he can't lie. And that's one of the reasons that lying is so bad in his eyes, I think, because he wants us to be like him and he can't lie. So we need to always filter through and figure out what the truth is.
And if we do lie, we need to correct it. So going along with that, I read somewhere, we're never further from God than when we lie. We're never closer to God than when we forgive. And that's probably two of the temptations we battle with. Okay, I went 2 minutes over, but that's okay. We'll take a break.